Thank you, Martha. I wanted to try and give a quick update on three fronts. One is on the regulatory review process. Second is on the legislative, the state legislative front. And the third is more generally on the property rights issues. So first, regulatory review. As Martha suggested, the Department of Energy is still in this mode of deciding what to do next. They've hired the contractors who will do the EIS. I think the thing that we all need to be most vigilant about is the next big thing that the Department of Energy does is they select which alternatives to study in this environmental impact statement. The scoping hearings that Martha referred to that many of you here were attending, that was the first step in trying to set the parameters for this environmental impact statement. But one of the big concerns that we have, and it's not just us, there are many other conservation organizations in New Hampshire have teamed up and we're working together on trying to monitor this whole process with the help of our congressional delegation. But the decision that they make on which alternatives to study is going to be critical. And usually these decisions are made in a room inside the Beltway in Washington, and they're not publicly vetted. And so the Conservation Law Foundation, the Forest Society, the Appalachian Mountain Club, the Nature Conservancy have all weighed in together saying, you know, this process needs to be a public process. It can't be a behind closed doors discussion within the Department of Energy. So that's very important. Another important step in this process is we all believe, the conservation organizations that I mentioned, that before you can make a one-off decision on an application from an organization like Northern Pass, there needs to be some considered analysis of just what role Canadian electricity plays in meeting the larger goals of New England, New York, and particularly New Hampshire. And that ought to be a discussion and it ought to be a subject of considerably more research than has been done so far, well in advance of making a decision on this project that's being proposed by Northern Pass. And the big fear is that if you keep doing these on a one-off basis, any utility that wants to build a high-voltage direct current power line through New Hampshire or Vermont or Maine could simply just go out and do what Northern Pass is doing right now, and it's not even part of a larger plan that the region or the states that have collectively agreed upon. So that's a big issue. The Department of Energy projects that this process of doing the environmental impact statement would be an 18 to 24 month undertaking. And by that, they mean the whole process from beginning to end. The next big public opportunity, at least as it's scheduled, to impact this process with comments, beyond present comments that you might want to make, is after they publish what's called the draft environmental impact statement. The draft environmental impact statement will be their analysis of these alternatives I was mentioning earlier, and their analysis of what each of the alternatives has to offer in the way of benefits and what might be detractions from each of those alternatives. They will not necessarily choose one best, although they could, but they will articulate in this draft environmental impact statement the alternatives that they've identified and researched and the one that they would identify as a preferred alternative. And as I said, they don't have to do this, but they could. They must legally address what's called the no-build option. So in order for this environmental impact statement to thoroughly do its job, not only do they look at other alternatives to bringing this power to market, but they look at the alternative of not doing the project, period. And our view is that that's a very important part of this environmental impact study. That analysis has to be thorough. Somebody actually has to ask the question, is $1.1 billion in societal money being best spent by importing power from Canada? Now, maybe it is, but the point is the question hasn't been asked yet and hasn't been answered. And somebody needs to ask the question, and this is the point of the no-build option, is society better served by investing that $1.1 billion in things other than Northern Pass and the way they propose to bring the power in? And I mean, if, for example, you could invest $1.1 billion and save 1,500 megawatts of electrical power from being consumed, wouldn't that be more desirable than spending $1.1 billion to import 1,200 megawatts from Canada? Those are questions that need to be asked and answered. If the DOE does a thorough analysis in the EIS, those questions will be asked and answered. But as I said, they're projecting this process to take 18 to 24 months. At the end of the 24-month period, when the final, after they publish the draft, they will hold another round of public hearings. They will take the input from those public hearings, and they will write a final EIS. Once they publish a final EIS, then the Department of Energy will issue a determination on the application for the special use permit that Martha described. That's a separate decision. The EIS is supposed to inform that decision. The Department of Energy views their task here as a very narrow task. Their task is to make the determination as to whether this should cross the international boundary. And there's two issues at stake. One is the public interest served by doing so? And secondly, is there a technical connection that serves both sides of this, in this case, the power line? The power systems can be integrated successfully. And that's the two issues that will be addressed. Now, the real decision about whether this actually gets sited in New Hampshire or not is made by the State Site Evaluation Committee. This is a statutorily established group of 15 current commissioners of state government. Northern Pass has suggested that they intend to apply for their Site Evaluation Committee permit after the Department of Energy publishes the draft environmental impact statement. And their thinking is that the EIS will be informative to the state for the Site Evaluation Committee's purposes of deciding whether this project actually gets built in New Hampshire or not. That's generally a 9-month process, the Site Evaluation Committee process. It's actually possible that the Site Evaluation Committee could make a decision before the Department of Energy decides whether or not to grant the permit. But in either case, the critical decision is the Site Evaluation Committee decision. And I think that there is a very legitimate concern that's being voiced by us and by many other organizations that the history, the track record the state has in making these decisions at the Site Evaluation Committee is not very from all of our perspectives, it's not very instructive, because generally, in the time I've lived in New Hampshire, the Site Evaluation Committee has simply made a decision: how can we permit this project? They have not asked the larger question: is this good for New Hampshire? Are there public benefits that outweigh any of the negatives? If they ask the question that way, which we argue is the right question to ask, and the right and the answers to those questions should be the right information on which they make a decision, you might get a very different answer than if you ask the question, what's the most painless way to permit this project? So that's what's going on the regulatory front. There are actually over 35 separate permits the project would require if a shovel were ever to hit ground. But they can't hit the ground with a shovel until both the presidential permit is awarded and the Site Evaluation Committee permit is awarded. On the legislative front, you've all heard a lot about this, so I won't go into a lot of detail. But the state senator from our area, Jeannie Forrester, has introduced two new pieces of legislation in addition to the legislation on eminent domain, the House Bill 648 that you've all heard about. Quick update on 648. The Senate Judiciary Committee will, by the 1st of December, make a recommendation to the full Senate on whether the Judiciary Committee believes the full Senate should act on this bill, and if so, how. Senator Forrester has introduced an amendment to the House-passed version of this bill, which we think is a big improvement over what was originally passed by the House. In any event, the committee will make a determination of what to recommend to the Senate, and the 24-member Senate will have a vote sometime by the third week in January on House Bill 648. It's really important that if you know people in other parts of the state who happen to know their state senator, or you know any of the state senators from any other parts of the state, to communicate with them. There was a vote, and I think it's a pretty good indicator vote. Back in June, 14 members of the Senate voted to essentially retain this bill, hold it over for another 6 months. 10 members voted against retaining the bill. Those 10 members who voted against retaining the bill have all made clear they intend to support 648. They wanted the bill acted on last session. They didn't have a majority. Our job is to get 13 votes for this in January. The second bill that Senator Forster, the new bill that Senator Forster has introduced, involves making improvements to the Site Evaluation Committee statute, which would specifically get at this big picture issue of addressing public benefits. Really important. And again, this bill will not be acted on in January. It might be acted on in the Senate committee in January, but this will be something that will be heard in the Senate between January, February, and early March. Whoops. And
thank you, John.
And then go over to the House in sometime in the middle of March. And if everything goes according to schedule, it would be voted on by both bodies by the end of May. So again, no, I don't even have a bill number on this yet. It's in the process of being drafted, but we will certainly make certain that if you sign up on the list out front, that you get this information. The third bill that Senator Forster has introduced, and I see Representative Suzanne Smith here, and I heard through the grapevine that you were doing something similar in the House, is to look at the feasibility of using state-owned transportation corridors, not necessarily just for Northern Pass, but as corridors for any kind of future transmission development need. And the reason why this is important is because, and I think I always look for silver linings in everything. The one good thing about Northern Pass is that it has made a lot of people in Concord start asking the question, the state really needs to think longer than one 2 year period about the future of how we're going to meet our energy needs. And it's clear that in the future we're going to have to keep generating electricity, and it's clear in the future we're going to have to keep transmitting electricity. So the latest technology out there actually allows you to transmit large volumes of electricity underground with a lot less impact underground than traditionally has been the case with existing technologies. So I think it's a smart move for the state on a couple of fronts. One is, if you could figure out a way to bury these high voltage, high elevation lines like Northern Pass, it solves almost all of the visual impact problems, and it actually makes the line more secure from storms like the one we just had. And there's a whole lot of benefit from doing this. And even if it's a little more expensive up front, which it probably is, when you add up the annual operation and maintenance costs over time, the new technology developers argue it's cost competitive, if not less expensive than overhead lines. So. And of course, the state has been in a somewhat challenged position in terms of generating revenue. So if the state of New Hampshire can lease its existing transportation corridors to power companies to transmit electricity, the state might even see some ka-ching out of this. And that's a good thing, I think. Although I must say, my only hesitation in this is that we first need to come to the conclusion that the importing of this power is desirable before we go through the process of figuring out what's the path of least resistance to getting it to market. You've probably all, I want to talk about a couple of property rights issues, and then I'll turn the mic over to our next speaker. But you've probably all heard about some of what's going on up in Coos County right now with Northern Pass looking for an alternative route through the county. Now, mind you, 95% of the people up there don't want it in any town in the county. But they are going up, and they're talking to landowners, and they have a big checkbook in one hand, and they have this little hammer called eminent domain in the other. And I think the really unconscionable thing that's happening right now, they don't have to mention the words eminent domain, because every landowner up there gets this from the get-go. They're basically offering a premium 5 to 10 times what the property is worth, you know, on the open market today otherwise. And they're saying, you know, take our premium now or we'll condemn the property at fair market value 2 or 3 years down the road. And that really is unconscionable. If the Constitution, as we would argue, prevents them from even exercising eminent domain in the first place, they should not be allowed to exercise any kind of explicit or implicit threat. Either we have the right under the Constitution to have that protected, or we don't. And I think this is a real challenge. But there's a number of people who stood up, and God bless them, have said, I'm not interested in the money. I'm not going to sell under any circumstances. So I actually think, based on what we know today, that the likelihood of Northern Pass getting a voluntary route through Coos County is less than 50-50. And I don't, you know, I'm not saying it will never happen. I'm just saying, based on what we know today, it doesn't look like they're going to get through. But the bad news there is that if they don't get through the voluntary route that they're looking for, they're going to go back to the original route that they went down the western side of the Connecticut River Valley. So this is not over, even if the good guys, the white hats, prevail up in along that alternative route. The other thing that I think most of us in this area understand. If you look at the Northern Pass website, they actually say that they need to acquire a widening of the existing right-of-way for 18 linear miles in 13 of the towns south of Lincoln. What this means is, in order for them to build on the lower end of the 90 to 135 foot elevation for these towers, they need to widen the existing rights-of-way. Well, If they can't negotiate a voluntary agreement with each of the landowners along that 18 miles, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to resort to eminent domain. And they've as much as said so. I mean, they always couch it by saying, well, it's, you know, the last resort and everything. But again, if you're a landowner and they're threatening eminent domain and they're coming to you and asking you to voluntarily sell them a right-of-way, so they can put a 90-foot tower in your backyard instead of a 135-foot tower, it seems to me that that's a little arbitrary and very unconstitutional. The last issue I wanted to talk about was, for those of you who may have read the Concord Monitor yesterday, there was a really good story about a couple in Pembroke who are facing this very situation. And the situation is that they have the existing right-of-way next to their house. They built the house 35 years ago knowing that that right-of-way was there, and they were willing to deal with the 45-foot poles that were there. But now Northern Pass is coming to them and saying, well, we need 45 feet more through your property. And the 45 feet we need, sorry to say, is 45 feet between the boundary of the existing right-of-way and your front door. And so this power line is literally going to, the lines are going to literally go over their bedroom if they actually do what they're proposing to do. Now, I think that the issue that this raises beyond the threat of eminent domain is a very basic common sense question. And that is, what is a reasonable use of an existing utility right-of-way? Are there limits to the use of an existing utility right-of-way? And we would argue that yes, there are. So the question then becomes, well, how do you define these limits? And if you look at the, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm probably walking on a little bit of unsolid ground here, but the lawyers that we've consulted, and we've done quite a bit of research on this, tell us that the history over the last 50 or 60 years of court decisions, really interesting. These court decisions actually identify something called the reasonable use doctrine. And the courts, the judges who write decisions on cases brought by individual landowners challenging the actual application of new uses of existing rights of way, the judges refer to this reasonable use doctrine. But there's no determination in any of the prior judicial decisions about what is an unreasonable use. So far, everything that they've decided has been reasonable, which is not real encouraging, because what it means is the courts have basically bent over backwards in favor of the utilities. However, we think that Northern Pass is such a departure from the normal utility, the normal use of an existing utility right-of-way, that there's fertile ground here to pursue. And I don't want to hold out a whole lot of hope. As I said, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like common sense would dictate that this Northern Pass power line is a very different critter from anything that's been designed and built in existing utility rights of ways. So there is a very compelling argument here that, and I'll give you one example, and we own a 1,400-acre property up in Bethlehem called the Rocks Estate. It has 1.3 miles of right-of-way, PS&H right-of-way, for which they are intending to put the Northern Pass transmission towers through. I don't think that the predecessor entitled to us in 1947, when he conveyed this right-of-way to Public Service Company, ever had the intention that a Canadian utility would be able to build a 135-foot group of towers through that property. That's just an unreasonable expansion of the use of the right-of-way that was originally acquired by PS&H for the purpose of providing power to end users in New Hampshire to keep their lights on. The other interesting question here is the money that was used to buy those rights-of-way was actually ratepayer money. It was money that we paid for those rights-of-way in our utility bills, or our grandfathers, grandmothers did. And, you know, if PS&H thinks that they're going to make any money off of these rights-of-way that were acquired with ratepayers, if you call the Public Utilities Commission, they will say, well, they're sadly mistaken if they think that, because the ratepayers should benefit from any income that comes from Hydro-Quebec for the use of those rights-of-way, not the shareholders of the utility. So there's a whole other issue there that needs to be explored a little bit further. But suffice it to say that, you know, if those of us who live in communities that have this existing right-of-way can keep raising this question and asking our elected officials and asking Public Service Company, you know, what is a reasonable use of this right-of-way? You originally bought it for one purpose, and now you're trying to tell us that there's a totally different purpose that's a legitimate use of this right-of-way. I think that most people, again, applying common sense, would say, hey, there's a threshold at some point, and we need to define what that threshold is. And with that, I'll sit down, and I'll be happy to answer questions later. For those of you who are interested in making comments to the Department of Energy, the email address and the snail mail address is inside this brochure. There's also the websites that Martha referred to earlier are also listed in here. And I know there's Joey, could you hand up one of those those orange cards? Because I think all of the email addresses. Okay. I think there's other, the point is there's information back there if you need it for getting access to good information. So thank you.